The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, welcome to this interview episode of Thinking Outside the Long Box. As always, I am Gabe, and today on the line we have Frank Gogol, who has been writing up a storm and getting a lot of accolades with his book Grief, Dead End Kids, and his upcoming No Heroin. Frank, how are you doing, man?
I am fantastic, and let me tell you, I am super effing, see, I did it, I moderated myself, super fucking excited to be back. You guys were actually my first ever podcast last year. And it feels like I've come full circle now.
Well, in that year, you have been super busy. You have, you know, released a ton of stuff. You know, you've gotten nominated for an award, like one of the big three comic book awards. You have received high praise from all sorts of different people. How has this year treated you, man?
Oh man, to like define it in one way would be just irresponsible. It has been so good and absolutely terrifying, like if I'm being completely honest, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is I got married last year, and that was before I had finished making Dead End Kids. I got engaged and after I made my con schedule for 2019. So in November, I nailed down my con schedule and got Dead End Kids approved and greenlit to be published. And then in December, I got engaged and we planned our wedding around Dead End Kids release and my con schedule. And like for the 6 weeks leading up to my wedding, I wasn't home. And for like the 4 weeks after, I wasn't home. And I'm honestly still shook to my core that I'm still married.
Man, if I'm gone for like a weekend, my wife is annoyed with me.
Well, and no, that's the thing. Like just last night, I got in from Vancouver where I was over the weekend working a convention, and I was just there. I left Saturday morning, came back Sunday night, so I was gone for like 44 hours, and that was like too long to be away from home. But like I do this every other week for most of the year, and I don't know why. Well, I do because I love doing conventions, but I also love my wife. It's a very, very buttery tightrope.
Is she not a big fan of going, or does she have like work commitments that prevent her from going with you?
She likes going. One of the ways we ended up getting together when we first met was because she was super interested in getting into comics, and we started working together, and I'm obviously a big fucking nerd, so I taught her, go read this, don't read that, and all that, and that's how we sort of got together. So she likes it. There are certain shows she likes to go to, like C2E2 is coming up in a couple weeks in Chicago. She comes to that with me every year because she loves Chicago, and that's a show that is particularly good for the after night stuff, or the evening stuff, because she knows a lot of the guys who do that show and my friends around there. So she has a good time. She does Seattle sometimes. She came out to Miami last year for SuperCon. It just depends on where it is and like what her schedule's like. She does work a full-time job. She's way more successful than me. She makes a lot more money than me. So her taking time off from work is way, way more important to keep track of than for me. So it's, you know, the answer to your question is yes, she does like going to cons.
That's awesome. Well, it's funny. One of the guys that hosts a show, his girlfriend comes with him to the conventions that he does locally, and you know she's not an artist. She's not. Like he
are we talking about Tim?
Yeah, we're definitely talking about Tim.
I know Tim. I've met his girlfriend when right. I did Denver last year.
So I love, like, every once in a while I walk up to the booth and, like, I'm all jazzed about whatever the fuck it is. I just saw, you know, oh my God, did you see that, you know, whatever ridiculous cosplay? Or, like, holy shit, they have a copy of something I want, but it's $400. You know, that kind of thing. And she always kind of looks at me like, man, you guys are a bunch of fucking dorks. You know, it's amazing.
You know what? That's exactly the opposite of my relationship. I am so reserved and conservative about like things that get me excited, and I don't know what that is about me, but I'm just generally like a low-key person. And my wife is like, just she's like, I just saw somebody who stitched together their Gandalf cosplay out of duct tape and used condoms, and I'm like, well, all right, that is kind of exciting, but that was a bad example. But she's just like. Like, she walks around the con floor and, like, she's entertained for hours. I walk through the con floor and I'm just like pissed. It took me 20 minutes to get across like 18 feet of space.
You're like, a lot of people just touched me and I'm not okay with this.
Yeah. I'm really always at odds with myself because I do love cons. I do love interacting with like fans and con goers, but I also hate crowds. I hate loud noises. I hate like not being productive, which cons are largely a lot of standing around. Like it's, I don't know. I'm always at war with myself, I guess.
That's okay, though. That's you know, that's how we get through all of this. I don't want to go to work, but I also need to survive. So let's do this thing.
Exactly.
So
with the added wrinkle that you love your job.
Oh, for sure. I love my job. You probably actually do love your job. So this is what I got to know. You got nominated for an award. That's a huge deal. You've been getting praise from like all over the place from a ton of cool people, including ourselves, which obviously we're the best podcast of all time. So there's that. But
how strongly agree. Strongly agree.
How has, you know, you talk about it being crazy. You talk about it being, you know, kind of intimidating and scary. Like, what has been like the biggest takeaway for you? Like, how are you going to respond to this coming year having gone through this past year?
Exactly the opposite of how I think I should, and I'll explain that, but that's really what it is. So when I started making comics, and I think we talked about this last time, essentially I hated the job I had at the time. I was super good at it. I was making great money. I just didn't like want to get out of bed in the morning and do it. And my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, she said to me, well, what do you want to be doing? And I thought for a second, I was like, well, I really want to just make some fucking comics. Like, I really just want to write comics. And she thought for a minute and then she said, well, what would that take? And like, it started this conversation that ended with her saying, you know what, if you want to take a year and tackle this and try and figure this out, take a year off work. We'll make it work. You have savings. I'm making good money. Like we can figure this out. What that made me do is, you know, once she talked me into saying yes, because that was like, that was such a big opportunity. And it was like wholly reliant, me being reliant on somebody else for support in ways that I had never been. It was pretty uncomfortable, honestly. And it's just, you never want to take advantage of people. Right. But what that opportunity made me do is say, I have to make the most of this. Like it's 365 days and every one of them has to count. So like, I mean, I treated it like a job. I would get up, I'd get ready and I'd sit at my computer or my notepad or whatever from 9 to 5 or some form of 8 hours every day for at least 5 days a week, if not 6 or 7. Like I really just, you know, nose to the grindstone and put the work in. That's where grief came from, honestly. And I think that first year really instilled in me this sense that I need to always, like, I've got this motto that I came up with a while ago that I just always sort of, it's always going through my head. It says, you know, grind or die. Like, you know, think of like your career as a shark. You know, they say that sharks don't ever stop moving, and if they ever do, they'll die. And like, that's how I try to treat things. So every year since then, I've tried to scale up what I did the previous year. So I put out a book. So then I put out a book and did 15 cons. Then I put out a book and did 12 cons or 17 cons and 17 signings. And every year is a little bit bigger. You know, as I sort of master more skills and build out a bigger network, I try to keep growing those things and bring new things into the fold. So like I said, last year, I think I did 16 or 17 cons and I did 17 store signings. Independently of it being 2020, I set a goal of 20 cons and 20 signings this year. I'm already on track to pass that the number of signings, and I think I'll hit the number of conventions, if not go a little bit over. But my gut instinct is always to like be reserved and conservative and have managed expectations, like I mentioned a couple minutes ago. And I also do worry that like I'm moving too fast. Like, you know, in the second and a half year of my career, I got nominated for one of the top 3 awards in the industry. Just yesterday, I won Best Writer of 2019 and Best New Series of 2019 at the Independent Creator Awards, which was like mind blowing. So like a lot of this is happening really fast. Like I submitted to Marvel last year, having only put out one miniseries. Like just all these big things are happening. And you know, none of that means anything. Yeah, like I'm not writing for Marvel. I'm not pitching to Marvel. Like but these are all just like big steps and they're all happening very fast, and everything in my person is telling me to slow down, take my time, and opposite of what I think I should be doing. I decided to do more cons, more signings, put out 2 books this year, do twice as many podcasts for No Heroine as I did Dead End Kids. I mean, like, it's just, I don't know how to do less. And that kind of terrifies me. But it also, I think, is at least one reason why I'm able to have the successes I'm having.
It, you know, it's interesting, just that sense of being driven, like, to accomplish things. Like, I often start out that way and then, like, flag off as, like, you know, time goes on. And to see you just going and going and going and going is super impressive. Like, it's, I envy your determination a lot of the time. So when you're approaching your books, you know, Grief, Dead End Kids, and, like, now No Heroine, you know, they all kind of touch on, like, really serious stuff, like, you know,
fucked up shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, as you know, I just reread Dead End Kids to just get it fresh in my mind. And, you know, that last page still hits, like, it hits like a ton of bricks, you know, because it's like you said, it's in the book. It's not a Stephen King story. You know, they're these friends, and yeah, they're outcast kids, but, like, things went fucking poorly because that's how normal life goes, you know?
Yeah.
And as you're looking forward to, like, No Heroine, it, like, you know, deals really heavily, while it's a fantasy, you know, world, it deals really heavily with drug addiction and that sort of thing. How do you, like, kind of manage dealing with something so serious, but also, you know, maintaining entertainment?
You know, that's something I think about a lot, and I don't know if I could put my finger on it. I can speculate at a couple things. One of the reasons I think it works, or it has worked so far, is because genre is always second for me. And I think we talked about this a little bit with Grief last time. I always start with a character story, something that I want to explore, either because the topic, like, that's you know, important to me, like, you know, addiction has affected my life, and, you know, not me personally, I've never been an addict, but a lot of people around me have been. And then I really wanted to sort of explore part of the addiction journey in a fair and honest way, like, you know, warts and all, and not in a demonizing way. Like, either these people are portrayed as, like, extremely sympathetic, like, overly sympathetic, and to the point where they don't have any responsibility for what they've done, or they're, like, completely demonized, and, like, they're just, yeah, exactly that, like, in society, like, they're just total outcasts and beyond repair. And I think that there's a huge gray area in the middle, and I just wanted to explore that. So I built a story for the main character, Kayla, about her journey being a recovering addict. Like, it's not, it's hard because this one, I took a little bit of a different approach than I did Dead End Kids. I knew I wanted to do a Buffy story, like a Buffy love letter, because Buffy has been so instrumental in my, you know, creative life, and it's one of my favorite, you know, stories of all time. But I told myself that, you know, the vampires and the monster hunting and all that bullshit is secondary to showing a human story. And I mean, I read a lot of comics. I probably read at least 100 single issues a month, like, if not more, just because of all the books I keep up with. I try to, you know, absorb as much as I can. And one of the things that I don't see a lot of, or am not finding a lot of in the stuff I'm reading is just really in personal human stories. Like, genre first is sort of the mode of, I mean, every big two comic for sure. And that's not a knock. It's just what the stories they're telling and how they're telling them. That's fine. It's just, I wanted to do something different.
So when you're looking at writing No Heroine, you know, you talk about how drug abuse has, like, really touched close to home for you. You know, you have a lot of people in your family and near to you that have suffered from it. And I think a lot of people can really relate to that, especially with, you know, Oxycontin and heroin and stuff like that. You know, drawing on that experience, are there, like, moments where you feel like, I need to redo this, or I need to recreate this moment because it doesn't seem true enough, or it doesn't seem real enough, or I'm not doing it, you know, due diligence?
I don't know that I would go back and redo anything, or that I have. I spent a lot more time at the plotting phase of this book than I did Dead End Kids and Grief, just by nature of the subject matter and how I worked through it with, you know, in regard to my own relationships. I would say that I told myself early on that this is a 3-issue miniseries. It could have been a 100-issue miniseries, and it would have never touched on every possible scenario, every angle, every minutia or you know, nuance of this experience that I'm trying to portray. And the same is true for Dead End Kids. I said to myself, just tell the story the best you can and try to, you know, be real about it. And I think that's one of the things, especially with Dead End Kids, that people dug. Like, I think there's a realness to it, and not to toot my own horn, because I don't know if that's fucking true. I look at these things, and it's very hard for me to distance myself because I created them. But I think that the anecdotal feedback I've gotten from talking to people at conventions and online is that, like, they enjoyed the character interactions in Dead End Kids. They seemed very real to them, and there was, like, an element of nostalgia. You know, No Heroine's not going to have a nostalgia element, but I'm still the same person writing the book, right? So whatever I brought to Dead End Kids, I'm bringing to No Heroine by virtue of the fact that I'm writing it.
You know, it's interesting. The moment that my dad's a recovering alcoholic, and he's been sober for, like, I want to say, like, 35, 36 years. So it's been a long time, but you know, there's that moment where she's on the payphone, where Kayla's on the payphone talking to her mom. And I remember my mom getting phone calls like that from my dad, and it was just so, like, visceral, like, in that moment. And then it just turns on its head, and it's a vampire story, and it's, like, super entertaining on top of it. The tightrope that you're walking with this is pretty impressive, and I cannot wait to read the rest of the book, you know. I'm only special enough to have read the first issue so far, so I'm super stoked to see where it goes. Like, when you're doing this work, when you're creating and kind of walking that tightrope, you know, are there things that you kind of try to latch on to, like, oh, this is the vampire part and this is the serious part, or do you just try to kind of make everything work as seamlessly as possible?
You know, I'm not a very rigid structuralist in the sense that, like, I absolutely abhor, like, I hate the idea of the three-act structure and totally deny that it's a thing. Like, it's I mean, like, any professional writer I've talked to has told me that it is like a Hollywoodization of the writing process, and it is so sterile. And like, I tried for a long time to really, like, teach it to myself, and I could never wrap my head around it. And, like, once I stopped trying to do that, like, story really opened up for me. So I treat the plot like exactly what plot is. Most people don't really understand what plot is, but plot is just this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, right? It's a series of events, and it's cause and effect. You know, Kayla's friend goes missing, so she decides to try and find him. Kayla investigates, and she gets a new lead, so she follows up on the lead. It's just cause and effect. That's what plot is. The other element of storytelling is the story side of it. It's like the emotional arc. And I just try to blend those two things. Like, every scene should do at least two things. One is move the story forward in the plot, and the other is, you know, reveal character and you know, move forward the arc or give some insight to the character and what they're going through. So there's a scene in there where Kayla stops at a church, and that one was, like, I think for me that's the most important scene in the whole book, because it does three or four things. First, it moves the plot forward by, you know, it's essentially the first stop on her mission, but it also adds a narrative plot element that comes into play later. I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
Yes, and there's some bait and switch with that, and that was a lot of fun to write. But the other thing is, it does a lot of revealing for character. Like, I mean, this is a woman who's desperate in a lot of ways, and she doesn't know what to do, and she's essentially on a suicide mission. And, like, the only let me back up here and talk a little bit about where the story came from. There are, from my point of view, this isn't scientific or medical or anything, but from my point of view, there are essentially, like, three phases to addiction. There's the first phase where you are, you know, you start doing drugs, you get hooked on drugs, and you're a drug addict. Now, this is sort of a part of an addict's life where there is no structure, there's no rules, and there's no need for it to be. You don't have to give a fuck. Like, you just do whatever you want, you do what you will, and you hurt who you're going to hurt. And, you know, the disease is sort of the horse pulling the cart. And for a lot of people, that's where it ends. Like, you know, overdose and you die, or you go to jail because you did something so stupid that you just get an insane sentence. And that's like the end of your life, metaphorically or literally. For the luckier few, you can go to jail or rehab and go through the second phase, which is sort of rehabilitation, where you are in an extremely structured situation like jail, where you have, you know, an itinerary for your day every single day. And it's, you know, the same thing over and over again, and it's imposed on you. Or rehab, which is probably a little looser, but essentially the same thing. It's an imposed structure. And then you get out, and that's the third phase, is recovery. And that's, from where I'm sitting, from my experiences, from like what I understand from knowing people who've gone through this, it's the hardest part, because you don't have the drugs telling you, you know, it doesn't matter, and you don't have anyone forcing a structure on you, and you're supposed to go out and just live a, like, essentially a perfect life, not get in trouble, not relapse, you know, just find a job, you know, find stability. And it's extremely hard. Like, you get out and you have, you know, you've probably alienated your friends, your family, you don't have a job right away, maybe you can't get hired because you're an ex-felon or an ex-drug addict. I mean, like, there's so much working against you, and all the weight is on you to have discipline, essentially. And what that makes you do is to some extent rely on other people. Like, I've seen this in my own life. My two of my best friends growing up, Tom and Joey, my brother and my cousin, or my cousin and my brother rather, who were two of the people I based characters in Dead End Kids on, have really struggled with heroin addiction since we were teenagers. I mean, like, this is pretty dark shit. But going back almost 20 years now, like, they've been on a cycle of be an addict, cause insane amount of trouble, get arrested, go to rehab, get out, struggle to maintain the structure, and relapse, and wash, rinse, repeat. So what happens is when these, you know, addicts are in sort of this recovery phase, they rely on other people to do certain things for them. Like when my cousin gets out of jail, sometimes he has to go to probation. He doesn't have a car because he doesn't have a job, because he doesn't have any money. He asks me to give him a ride to probation, and I absolutely do every single time he asks me to. But it's like, the second people start doing something for you, it becomes easier to ask for them to do something else for you. You know, it's like, can I borrow $50 to cover my bus fare for the week until I get paid? And it's a fine line that these people have to walk between asking for help that they really need and taking advantage because they're desperate. And so that's the picture I wanted to paint with Kayla. This is a woman who has a friend, Sid, who is also a recovering addict, and he's found his own structure, and he has enough structure in his own life that he can lend her some help and help her stay disciplined. And he goes missing. And honestly, she's less worried about what's going on with him and more worried about what's going to happen to her if he's not around. So she's doing the right thing trying to find him, but she's doing it for the wrong selfish reason. Kayla's not a good person. And I think that's part of what I like about her as a character. She's imperfect, but she's trying. Like, you know, I think of characters like John Constantine, who's like a real piece of shit, but like, in the end, he does the right thing, or he tries to, at least. A lot of times he makes things worse for himself. So I don't really remember what question I was supposed to be answering.
That's okay.
This happens to me every single time I'm on a movie. I should start writing them down.
No, it's good. That's good stuff, man. Like, that's exactly, like, you know, it's hard to get to the heart.
Oh, I remember.
Go ahead.
We were talking about the church scene. All right, so she's there. It starts this next section of plot for the book, adds a narrative element that comes into play later, but it also gives you a window into her psyche. She's not a very religious person. She confesses that in the narration when she gets to the church. But honestly, she's so desperate that she's looking for help wherever she can get it. So she's looking to God. She says a prayer. And it's like a really beautiful, quiet scene. And Chris Madd, who did the art, like, he came up with this great idea to have the stained glass in the church above her be the last temptation of Christ, which, you know, temptation is a big thing with recovering drug addicts. And it's, there's a lot of sort of visual and narrative poetry there. But anyway, that's one of the ways in which the character is revealed. And that's one of the things I think every scene should do: reveal character, explore the character arc, further it, like, make it take a step back if she's fucks up, and move the plot along.
Deep breath. So this is what I love about doing these interviews, is because it's hard. I think it's hard really to get to the heart of like the creative process in a lot of ways, because everybody is different. Like if you're any kind of creative person, you know, like I make podcasts, I make videos, you know, I do some drawing. I'm not very good at it, but I do it, you know, and I do some design work. And my creative process is very different from everybody else that I know that has a creative process. So it's interesting to hear, you know, you drawing on life experience, you drawing on, you know, the comic books that you read and, you know, what you are and aren't seeing in the market, you know, and being able to like dig deep and like listen to a writer or an artist just talk about what they're creating. I think so many people just don't understand like what goes into the entertainment that they consume. You know, we watch, we read, we listen, and you know, I might love this band, but I'm never going to be there for the hours and hours of practice that they do to create that album that I love. I might love your comic book, but I'm never going to be around for the hours and hours of writing that you do to make it, you know, that thing that I love. So I love getting to hear, you know, why and how and what inspires you guys. So when every writer, every artist, every creative that we've had on the show, they go on this tangent and I try to shut my mouth and just listen, which I'm clearly not doing right now, but
God, shut up.
I know, right? No, I'm kidding. But like, I try to shut my mouth and just listen, because it's you getting to the heart of your own process. And that's like really cool to listen to you figure out a lot of times, and you know, not necessarily you in specific, but a lot of times it's somebody figuring out for the first time like why they did something the way they did it, and that's really cool to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually I have like three thoughts that I don't want to lose, because I'm definitely going to lose them because my brain is broken, I guess. First, there's a concept in poetry called duende. It's a Spanish word. I think it means trolls under the bridge, or from trolls under the bridge, or something like that. It doesn't mean anything like that, like in regards to poetry. But it's this idea that like sometimes you just experience like a piece of art, a painting, a movie, a comic book, and for reasons you can't put your finger on or understand, you just inherently understand that it's good. Like it's like people look at the Mona Lisa and they can't tell you why they like it or why it's a good piece of art, but they just, you know, sort of universally it's understood that it is. And I think that part of what that is, that experience is recognizing, without recognizing it, like the time and effort and love that goes into making something. Like, I mean, you don't realize that, you know, Da Vinci put in hundreds of thousands of hours of work in his life and, you know, learning painting techniques and lighting and oil, you know, chemistries and stuff like that to become such a good painter. But like, it's in the back of your mind when you look at that painting, and that's part of why we see things as good, I think. So just because you don't recognize it doesn't mean you're not cognizant of it. And I think that's important to recognize, because we do appreciate art and these things. And even if we can't put our finger on it, doesn't mean we don't. And that doesn't mean there aren't reasons why. And I forgot the other two things, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, man. This is literally my life. Like, I smoke so much weed that sometimes I'm like, oh, I have all these great ideas and they're gone.
Now, are the great ideas a result of the cannabis use, or are they there first?
No, they're there first, and then they just go away.
Yeah, right.
No,
I'm teasing. Yeah.
I came up with one story that I thought was amazing when I was stoned one time. I wrote it out and I read it the next morning and it went right into the garbage can.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So now I got to ask the fun question, because I love this. I'm a vampire dork, okay? I love vampire legends. I love all the different ways that they can be killed and like all the sorts of different like mythologies behind it. You know, you have pretty straightforward, like afraid of the Christians, you know, vampires. What made you choose to just go with like pretty straightforward vampires, but with pointy ears and dark skin?
I mean, the visuals were all Chris. Like, I'm a very scarce scripter, and like Just because, like, I fear putting too many words on the page and being overly directive. So I do a pretty bare bones scripting and bare bones character descriptions. On the one hand, it lets me be really lazy. On the other hand, I think it makes for a better collaboration. So when Chris came in to do the mock-ups for the vampires, that was all him. Like, it was his vision of what vampires are, and outside of any changes that needed to be made for story needs, which I don't think there were, it's largely what he came up with. So yeah, you'd have to ask Chris about the skin and the pointy ears. I think they look dope. I'm really happy with how they came out. In terms of like the lore that I drew on, I'm not, like, really honestly very much into world building. It's just, you only get so much space in a comic, and comics are really expensive to make. And my creative take on it is, like, if it doesn't need to be there, it's not necessary. Like, and I know Tolkien is rolling over in his grave right now with me saying that, because Lord of the Rings is a masterpiece, but there's, you know, like 80% of it isn't actually the story.
Right.
Which is fine. That's just not how I tell stories. So honestly, like, because it was, again, my love letter to Buffy, I think subconsciously I was drawing mostly on that, you know, sort of mythology of the vampire. You know, like, it's there's some Christian aspects of it, you know, garlic and steaks and you know, the way they blow up has a sound. Like, I mean, but yeah, it was just like whatever I needed to get it done. Like, that sounds really unromantic and like not particularly creative, but like, again, like, that's everything for me is set dressing for the character arc. Like, if it doesn't serve, you know, Kayla's story, I ask myself, is it absolutely necessary to put a lot of effort into this? And like, again, that sounds really lazy, but I mean, you read the book, like, it's, there's a method to the badness.
Yeah. It's like you said, genre second, you know, the world around it isn't as important as the people occupying it. And that's actually exactly a really cool way to approach it.
Well, you know what? I learned it from Paul Aller, who is writing G.I. Joe right now, and he's done a lot of Ninja Turtles. He's done some Power Rangers, which I'm super fucking jealous about. But Paul has been one of my writing mentors for the last couple of years, and I've taken a few classes with him and talked with him a bunch. And the way he sort of explained it to me, and I really respected this, and it really stuck with me, is think of it like a spaghetti Western movie set. Like, you know, on film, you see the two guys at noon set ready to have the shootout, and you've got all the storefronts for the saloon and the sheriff and the bail bondsman, and you got this whole sort of main street set up. But if you like walk around back to behind the saloon, like, you just see that it's all wood on stilts. Like, it's all set dressing to serve the story. Like, it doesn't need that much thought. It just has to look right and function right. Right. And that just, I don't know, for me being the kind of practical and pragmatic storyteller that I try to be in terms of like function and stuff like that and story, like, that really resonated. And it's how I did Dead End Kid. It's how I did all of Grief. It's how I've done No Heroine. It's how the books that are coming have all been done. And it doesn't seem to have affected anyone's sort of reception of the book in any meaningful or significantly negative way. So I'm just going to keep rolling.
Yeah, you definitely aren't getting a whole lot of negative reception. Like, people are.
I got one bad review.
A whole one.
Well, you know what? I take umbrage with it too. All right, so Dead End Kids reviewed really highly across all issues, across all reviews, and like, I'm not gloating, and I'm just, you know, those people could be wrong. I don't know, but the one bad review we got was like a month after the book, the last issue came out, and it was like a 4 out of 10. By a reviewer who had given the first two issues like perfect tens, and his one gripe was that he couldn't get over the fact that the series wasn't 12 issues long and he wasn't getting more of it, which I guess is like a good review in a weird way, but I don't know. Like, I'm still not salty, but I'm still thinking about how to feel about that one.
That's probably the best possible bad review you could get. I'm going to be second really
best. Second best.
What's the second best bad review you could get?
First best bad review is my buddy David Pepos, who does Spencer and Locke and Going to the Chapel over at Action Lab. Mm-hmm. He got, I can't remember which issue of Spencer and Locke, the first volume it was, but he got a review that essentially the thesis of it was, this book is kindergarten Alan Moore. Which, this was his first book. He had never published before. It was amazing.
Yeah. And to be compared to Alan Moore. It's a really good book.
Like, somebody could walk up to me on the street and be like, you are as good as one of Alan Moore's dumps. And I'd be like, thank you.
Sold.
to say I'm as good a writer as Alan Moore was when he was 5 or 6 years old, I'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah, I'm currently in the middle of rereading Watchmen, so I'm going to have to agree with that.
Yeah, he wrote that when he was like 24.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, it's prophetic and ridiculous and amazing.
It's offensive. I'm never going to write Watchmen, and I'm 32. Like, it's just...
I'm never going to read Watchmen or write Watchmen, and I'm like 42. So I'm right there with you, man.
Yeah.
Well,
I like Alan. Alan seems like a good guy.
Sorry, I got to do this tangent really quick, and then I
tangent
gotta,
away, my man.
There's a video out there of somebody interviewing Alan Moore, and she's like, "Okay, like if you're a wizard, blow up this lemon." And you know, he stares really intently at the lemon, and then nothing happens. She's like, "That's what I thought. That's what I thought." He stares really intently at it again. He's like, "Just a second, I got this." And she's, yeah, whatever, okay, fake wizard. And then he stares really intently again, and the interview lady's head explodes. And, like, everybody starts screaming, and the camera gets hectic. But for, like, 1 second, it's, like, full frame of Alan Moore's face, and he just gives you, like, this sly little grin, and then everything cuts to black. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah.
You know what? It's interesting because I'm actually a pretty big – I don't believe I'm a wizard, and I'm not sure Alan Moore is one either. But his sort of definition of like how magic works and why he considers himself a wizard is actually something that like is pretty cool, and it really resonated with me when I heard it the first time. So his idea of magic is like a really bare bones take. Like it's essentially the power to affect change in the world around you, right? That's like a very basic definition of magic. And what he means when he says he's a wizard, I think he does think he can do like parlor tricks and shit like that. But what he means when he says he can do magic is when you write and you write a book like Watchmen and you use words to write it, and it has such a profound impact on people that you know, they react to it. That is using words to affect change in the world around you. And like by his definition, that meets the idea of magic. And I really like that because like my favorite books, movies, TV shows are the ones that make me feel emotions. Like I like Buffy because it caused me pain to watch the characters suffer. And like They use words and images just like comics, and like they affected me with those words and images. They made me choke up. They made me throw a fucking pillow across the room. They made me smile. And like that, I mean, you know, obviously no one's pulling fucking rabbits out of their hats or jumping to the moon, but like the ability to make other people feel things is so incredibly underrated, and it's like one of the things that I strive for when I write, and that's why the last page of Dead End Kids is the one it is.
Oh, it was successful. Like that shit chokes me up every time I read it. So
if you think that was fucked up, wait until you get to the middle of the last issue of No Heroine, and then there's still half a book left.
Oh man, I genuinely can't wait to read it, and I know our listeners are going to be really excited to read it. So as we're wrapping up, Frank, can you let everybody know how they can find you and where they're going to be able to get a copy of No Heroine?
Yeah. So you guys can find me on all the social medias, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. For Twitter and Instagram, my handle is just my name, @FrankGogol, one word, FrankGogol. I have a Facebook, too, not like a fan page or any of that bullshit that doesn't work. But I do have an account, and I'm more than happy to connect with people and engage with people. If you're a creator and you want to ask questions, feel free to shoot me a friend request. If you're a fan, or if you just want to know more about anything, if you want to talk about Buffy, I guess, you know, Power Rangers, I don't care. Shoot me a friend request. Just don't be a Nazi and we're good. For No Heroine, just real quick, the elevator pitch, it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer if she was a recovering heroin addict. Like, I mean, it's monster hunting, it's punk rock, it's deeply fucking emotionally jarring. It's in stores in June, so as of this recording, we don't currently have the pre-order code, but honestly, you don't need it. When April rolls around, it'll be in previews. Just go into your shop, tell them you want No Heroine, tell them you want that new Frank Gogol book, tell them you want that new Source Point Press book about the vampire and the punk chick, almost any of that information will be enough. If you're worried you might forget, go back to one of the aforementioned social medias and just give me a follow. I talk about this shit way more than I should, and you will definitely stay reminded.
That's awesome, man. Well, Franks, thank you so much for coming on our show again, man. It's always a pleasure. I am very excited to see what 2020 brings for you. If it's anything like 2019, I'm sure it'll be just as exciting as fighting vampires.
You know what? It will, and it'll also include Dead End Kids too, and that's all I'll say about that.
Oh man, you teasing son of a bitch! Are you? Oh, that's awesome. Well, when that starts happening, you better come back on the show and talk about it, man.
We will chat in September then, my friend.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm super excited for it. Again, thank you so much for being on the show, Frank. We really appreciate your time.
Dude, thanks for having me. And again, like I said earlier, like this feels like I'm coming full circle. You guys were my first. You popped my podcast cherry. So,
Oh man, nothing has ever been more accurate to this show than the sentence I just said. So,
oh man.
Well, Frank, thanks again, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.